This is a recording of the open meeting of the Federal Election Commission held on October 9, 2014. Should you have questions after listening to the recording, please call the FEC at 1-800-424-9530 or email us at info@fec.gov.
Team will now come to order. Madam Vice Chair, I believe we have a few late submitted documents. Is that right?
Yes, we do. And would you want to do the late submitted documents first?
Why don't we get those out of the way?
I move to suspend the rules on the timely submission of agenda documents in order to consider the late submission of, and I do apologize to the public for all of these late submitted documents, agenda document number 14-53-A, draft of Citizens United versus FEC final rule, agenda document number 14-51-A, draft of McCutcheon and FEC interim final rule, agenda document number 14-52-A, draft of McCutcheon versus FEC ANPRM, agenda document number 14-50-A, draft of AO 2014-12 DNC and RNC, agenda document number 14-50-B, draft B of AO 2014-12 DNC RNC, agenda document number 14-48-A-2, draft of AO 2014-14 Trammell, agenda document number 14-49-A-2, draft of AO 2014-15 Bratt.
That's a repeat. No, how about 49?
1449A2. I have that. That's Bratt.
Oh, that was Bratt. Okay. Any others?
No, those are them.
Okay.
Not enough.
Yeah.
Any comments? Okay. Then we'll vote. All those in favor of the motion, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Any abstentions? The motion passes by a vote of 6-0, Madam Secretary. Okay, the first item on today's agenda, then, is the correction and approval of the minutes for September 18, 2014. Madam Vice Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move to adopt agenda document number 14-47-A, minutes for the open session held on September 18, 2014.
Any comments or corrections to the minutes? Hearing none, we'll vote. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed or abstentions? The motion passes by a vote of 6-0. Okay. The next items on our agenda, items 2, 3, and 4, are final rules on independent expenditures and electioneering communications by corporations and labor organizations. Item number 3, the McCutcheon v. FEC interim final rule. And item 4, McCutcheon v. FEC advance notice of proposed rulemaking. And to facilitate discussion of these related items and without objection, we will discuss these three items together. Each commissioner can discuss any aspect of these three items, and when it's time for motions, we will take up each item separately so that each commissioner can vote separately on each unique item. So without objection, we will proceed that way. Mr. Adav Noti, Ms. Esther Jory, and Mr. Theo Lutz from our Office of General Counsel are here. And I would ask Mrs. Jory to begin with a presentation of Item 2, the final rules on independent expenditures and electioneering communications by corporations and labor organizations, followed then by Mr. Lutz, who will present Item 3, the McCutcheon v. Federal Election Commission interim final rule, and Item 4, the McCutcheon v. FEC advance notice of proposed rulemaking. But before you begin, I'd like to recognize Mr. Noti and his staff, including Esther, Ms. Jory, Cheryl Hemsley, Bob Knopp, Theo, Amy Rothstein, and Joanna Waldstreicher. Joanna, thank you for your excellent work in drafting these items before us and doing a lot of work to get these before the commission in the shape that they're in. This has been excellent work, and I know all commissioners, regardless of their position, on the substance of each matter, appreciates the good work that you've done. So thank you. Ms. Jory, thank you, and the floor is yours.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good morning, commissioners. Agenda document 14-53A is a draft of final rules and an explanation and justification regarding the making of independent expenditures and electioneering communications by corporations and labor organizations. The Commission approved a notice of proposed rulemaking that was published in the Federal Register on December 27, 2011. The draft final rules include revisions to the regulations implementing the statutory prohibitions on corporations and labor organizations making independent expenditures and electioneering communications. The draft also revises other regulations in light of the Supreme Court's decision in Citizens United. If the Commission approves the draft final rules and explanation and justification, the Office of General Counsel seeks authority to make technical and conforming changes to that draft and will submit the draft with any technical and conforming changes for publication in the Federal Register. Thank you, and I would be happy to address any questions that you may have.
Let me go to Mr. Lutz for a presentation, and then if there are any questions, we can take them up in a, together.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Also before you are two draft notices that follow from the Supreme Court's decision in McCutcheon versus FEC. Agenda document 1451A is an interim final rule that removes from commission regulations the aggregate limits on contributions by individuals to federal candidates and political committees in each two-year election cycle. The document provides for a 30-day comment window. Agenda document 1452A is an advance notice of proposed rulemaking that requests comments on whether to begin a rulemaking to revise certain commission regulations in light of the McCutcheon decision. The document provides for a 90-day comment window and for a hearing on February 11, 2015. If the commission approves these drafts, the Office of General Counsel seeks authority to make technical and conforming changes. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Jory. Mr. Lutz, the floor is now open for the commission to ask questions of Ms. Jory, Mr. Lutz, or more generally consideration and discussion of agenda items 2, 3, and 4. Would any commissioner like to speak on these issues? Vice Chair Ravel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't have any questions. I've spent some time reviewing the work done also by OGC, and I'm very impressed by the work you did in a very short, truncated period of time. So I thank you so much for your willingness to stay up late at night and over the weekends and work on this to try to get it in the shape that it's in. I just want to make a comment about this package. Obviously, everybody knows that this is something that I've worked on, and I think it is because, given the changes that we've seen in the legal landscape over the last 5 years, it's important. In fact, it is the obligation of this commission to perform its function and provide as much clarity to the public and the regulated community about what the rules are and how to comply with the law. This agreement, at long last, almost 5 years since Citizens United was decided, provides some of that much-needed clarity. Like any compromise, it doesn't completely address all the issues that I would have wanted to include. The notice of proposed rulemaking on CU that was referred to, which was released in 2011, long before I arrived at the commission, did not address those issues specifically. And so we were constrained by that NPRM, which was voted on by the commission prior to my arrival. In particular, it didn't discuss the disclosure of independent expenditures, which is something that I do care about. But we are precluded from including that issue in these regulations, even though eight justices of the Supreme Court in Citizens United upheld the Act's disclosure requirements. But I will continue on the commission to work with my fellow commissioners to ensure full disclosure in the political system. But one aspect of this agreement that does make this commission more open, transparent, and responsive is that it includes a mechanism for public comments and a public hearing on core issues related to campaign finance law. That public hearing will be held on February 11th, 2015, on issues that are fundamental to campaign finance. This is a historic departure from how the Commission has engaged in rulemaking, and it's an opportunity for all members of the public and the regulated community to speak to the Commission, either by written comment or in person. We encourage everyone. We want a full range of comments and opinions on the issues that will be presented, and we encourage everyone to comment and to participate in that hearing. I particularly would like to thank and commend Commissioner Hunter, who is my colleague on the Regulations Committee, for her reasonable and helpful approach to trying to reach agreement here. She is a tough but very gracious negotiator, and I look forward to working with her more on many other issues that will come before us and bringing up more regulations for the consideration of the public. I also want to thank Chairman Goodman for his work on helping to facilitate this agreement. He was an indispensable participant in this process. And more importantly, and I know we've spoken about the great work of OGC, high praise also needs to go to our staffs, all of our respective staffs, who all worked very late into the night. I know because I was safely in my little apartment getting emails from them at midnight, deciphering arcane provisions and, most importantly, explaining them to us. But particularly, I would like to give thanks to my amazing EA, Laura Basford, who has not only sacrificed those long nights, but many a weekend, and has become so enmeshed in this rule that she could probably write a book on it if anybody ever wanted to read it. Probably not, is my guess. But anyway, thank you.
Mr. Hunter.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Today is a good day for the Commission. It sends a positive sign for future cooperation. 4 years and 8 months ago, since Citizens United was decided, as was mentioned, there was much debate over what to put in the NPRM. We went back and forth. There's a lot of ink spilled on that and many, many conversations that we had at public meetings in the past. Eventually, an NPRM was adopted with 5 votes in 2011, which I believe properly focused on the provisions the court declared unconstitutional. As Vice Chair Ravel mentioned, when she came to the commission, she told us that she was willing to work with us after many years of not having a lot of movement on this issue and after a significant number of public comments on the NPRM that, again, was put out in 2011 before she was there. She said, "I'm willing to work with you on putting something out," and we welcomed that participation. She's also a tough negotiator, but she's very cooperative and a pleasure to work with. It was important to Vice Chair Ravel that she asked questions about the McCutcheon decision, and so today we vote on a package deal, and I will vote for all 3 documents today. We asked some general questions raised by certain language from the McCutcheon decision, but I think we only ask questions that the Commission has the authority to change under FECA, which I think makes perfect sense why I asked the public questions that we think is in the purview of Congress to change those laws. So we, too, look forward to your comments and welcome comments from everyone. It's a rare time in Washington for government agencies to remove regulations from the books, so I'm delighted that we're doing that so today here for 2 important Supreme Court opinions and to uphold our commitment to the First Amendment. I'd also like to thank the chairman for shepherding us through and keeping us on a very strict time schedule. You might be wondering, 4 years, 8 months isn't all that strict. But again, once Commissioner Ravel signaled her willingness to work with us, he shepherded us through in a very quick manner, and we appreciate it. And to Vice Chair Ravel for her diligent cooperative efforts, and Laura Basford, Alex Sasanovich, Lee Evans, all of the OGC staff that we've mentioned earlier here today, thank you to all of you for your very hard work. Cheryl, I think Cheryl Helmsley as well, thank you so much. And a special thank you to Eric Brown, who worked on the Citizens United rulemaking. Eric's back in the audience hiding from everyone. And Rebecca Marino, who's back over here, for her hard work on the McCutcheon AMPRM. Thank you very much.
I usually like to go to this side.
Do you want me to speak, Mr. Chairman? You're looking at me.
I think free speech is a good thing. I think more speech we get, the better democracy is served. So, Commissioner Weintraub.
I'm glad to hear it. I'm glad to hear you're in favor of free speech, so am I. Oh, I'm sorry. I'm going to ruin the kumbaya moment here. Follow the money. It's become a cliche in Washington and in this country to get to the bottom of what's really going on. If you want to find out who's responsible and who's interested and what people's motivations are and why they're doing what they're doing, you have to follow the money. That's our job. Almost 40 years ago, this agency was created with that express mission of following the money and making that information available to the American public. When it comes to contributions and the money that is raised and spent to fund our elections. But we're falling down on the job because already this year we've seen over $100 million in dark money spent on the 2014 election. And there's our friends over at the Center for Responsive Politics are estimating that could go as high as $700 million. That is a lot of money that is out there that is trying to influence voters and trying to influence the people that will ultimately get elected. And nobody knows where it's coming from. So there's no way to judge, as the Supreme Court said, which members are in the pockets of which special interests, which was a value that the Supreme Court upheld. How did we get here? I'll try and give the short version of the history of all this. And, you know, I think I have the utmost respect for the vice chair, and in some respects, I guess it's easier because she came in after all this happened. But in 2002, Congress passed the Bipartisan Campaign Reform Act, and that included provisions that corporations and labor organizations couldn't fund certain communications that were defined as electioneering communications, and that there would be disclosure of who was funding those communications. And that provision, the funding restriction was struck down in the Wisconsin Right to Life decision, and the commission at that time unanimously thought, well, we should do a rulemaking quickly to try and implement that decision. And within 6 months, we did. And I have to tell you that if there is one thing that I could undo from my years on the commission, it would have been to say, no, let's say no. We don't actually have to do anything to implement that decision. We would have saved a whole lot of grief if we had not gone down that road. As part of that rulemaking, even though the Wisconsin Right to Life decision didn't address disclosure, our Republican colleagues at the time, nobody who's sitting at the table today, thought that disclosure was implicated by that decision, and they wanted to raise that issue in the rulemaking. And consistent with the long-standing practice of the commission, if somebody wanted to raise an issue in a rulemaking document, they got to do that. So we said, okay, you can do that. And at the end of the day, as part of a compromise, we added some language to 104, Section 104, C8 and C9, 104.20, C8 and C9, that addressed disclosure for corporations and labor organizations. And the motivating factor for my colleagues was that they were convinced in the Wisconsin Right to Life, after reading Wisconsin Right to Life, that just as the funding restrictions were struck down, the disclosure restrictions that went along with them were sure to be struck down in the next decision.
Well, along comes Citizens United, taking that very case to the Supreme Court. And Citizens United was a dramatic, game-changing decision because the court went so far beyond what the original plaintiffs had brought to the table. But along the way, the court said, disclosure is great. Disclosure does not have the same failings as the funding restrictions. In fact, it's important for us to have an informed electorate, for people to understand who is behind, who is funding all of these ads. They were very enthusiastic. They resoundingly upheld those provisions, which ran directly contrary to the assumptions of the commissioners who had originally been pushing for those restrictions in the Wisconsin Right to Life rulemaking. So now we sit here at the end of a long process because when we went to implement Citizens United, our colleagues told us that we couldn't touch the disclosure provisions, despite the fact that those provisions had been added on a complete misunderstanding of where the court was going. They said, we like that. We like those provisions. They undermine disclosure, and we're okay with that. And we don't want to hear from the American people. We don't want you to put out a proposal that would say, how should we comply with Citizens United? Should we comply with it in a way that locks in the current disclosure regime, or should we comply with it in a way that advances disclosure, which I think would be more faithful to the ruling, which was a pro-disclosure ruling. Whatever else it did, it was a pro-disclosure ruling. And they said, no, you can't put your proposal out there for comment. We do not want to hear those comments. It was not a very pro-First Amendment decision, actually, by my colleagues, because they weren't interested in having that wide open, robust debate that the First Amendment is supposed to protect. They wanted to rig the game so that at the end of this process, the only alternative would be the one that is adopted today that keeps in place these disclosure restrictions that are part of the problem that is leading to this explosion in dark money. And this has been dramatically exacerbated since Citizens United. The situation that was in front of the court is not the situation that exists today. They are not getting what they envisioned, a system where there would be a lot of freedom for people to buy as many ads as they want to, but everybody would know who was behind those ads. And that is not, unfortunately, the system that we have here today. And I know that some people are hungry for this commission to be more functional than it has been. And Lord knows I am hungry for this commission to be more functional than it has been. And it's been suggested, can't you just find the stuff that you can all agree on? I mean, certainly there are parts of Citizens United that are incontrovertible. They say what they say. Can't you just agree on that? And the problem with that is that in this rulemaking, there is no way to segregate out the disclosure provisions because there was an attempt to try, and then my colleagues realized that, no, actually, because of the cross-references, we have to deal with 104.20C, 8 and 9. There's no way to avoid it because the rules won't make sense unless we clean them up. But they said, well, we're only going to look at three words. You can't look at the rest of the sentence. You can't ask the American public what they think of the rest of the sentence because we don't want to hear those comments. If we put that out for comment, people might like the idea of having more disclosure. Certainly all the polls that I've seen indicate that people really want to have more disclosure. But those views were not welcome here at the FEC. And I think that's very unfortunate. So it's impossible for me to vote for the Citizens United rule because it leaves in place this disclosure regime that I think really undermines what Congress was trying to achieve and what the Supreme Court has endorsed in terms of disclosure. I got a letter recently from Patricia Ellis of Greenwood, Mississippi. I didn't put anything out for comment. She just wrote to me. Dear Commissioner Weintraub, it is my hope that you and your commission will change the American people's loss of power over their government. When American citizens vote into office their congressman, they expect the congressman to represent the wishes of their constituents. However, this no longer happens. Congressmen have been bought by lobbyists, special interest groups, and PACs. This has corrupted our government so badly that Congress represents only these groups. While congressmen get richer by the flow of money and gifts from these groups, their constituents grow poorer. Common sense legislation for the people is forgotten. Bills laden with pork regulations and special interests for lobbyists that hurt common Americans are business as usual. This corruption also exists in elections, with lobbyists, special interest groups, and PACs pouring support into the campaigns of candidates that support them. The Supreme Court ruling that paved the way for super PACs with its Citizens United decision has further undermined the influence of the everyday American on the nation's politics. This is fraud on the American citizen. Something must be done to stop this deception against the American citizen. Can you or your commission do something to restore the power of the United States government back into the hands of the American citizen? What can the average American citizen do to be heard and represented well? I think we could do a lot more than we are doing. I appreciate that we're going to have a hearing on an advance notice of proposed rulemaking, and I hope that we get a lot of comments. I encourage Ms. Ellis to comment and anybody else out there to comment on the issues that are of concern to them that they want the commission to be paying attention to. It's an advance notice, which means the commission's not committing itself to actually doing a rulemaking. So we really, really need to hear from people. If you want us to act, you're going to have to persuade everybody at this table, or at least four people at this table, that there's a need to act. So I really hope that we will get robust comments on this. I should also say that in addition to the disclosure issues, which are so important, there are other issues that the commission is not dealing with here today and we were not allowed to deal with here today that I think are important to the American people. When corporations are given a lot more freedom to speak, that raises questions, because corporations may be legal persons, according to the Supreme Court, but they're not really people. We know that. There are differences, and it raises issues that we really need to consider. Corporations, for example, unlike people, real people, thank God and Abraham Lincoln, corporations can be owned, and people can't. So when you have corporations, in fact, all corporations are owned. They're owned and controlled by others. Some of them are owned and controlled by people in other countries, by individuals, by corporations, by foreign governments. And the foreign national ban still stands. So I think we really need to take a look at how the corporate structure, with its inherent ownership principles, how to interpret that in light of those freedoms, in light of the foreign national ban. Because, and I don't know why this should be a partisan issue. I would think everybody would be interested in protecting our politics from foreign interventions. So I don't know why we can't get that issue off the ground. I'm also very concerned about potential coercion of employees and union members when the corporation is overtly involved in politics. What does that mean for employees who may not share the views of their employers or of their union leaders? How does this affect them? How do we protect them from being coerced into political activities that do not reflect their own views, which they have a right to express or not express? I think there's, and then there are other issues that we could have considered. I think the corporate facilitation rules really need another relook. And I think that was an issue that there was some interest in addressing, except that when the position was adopted that we were just going to do a stripped down rulemaking, that also got left on the cutting room floor, and that's unfortunate. So I wish that we could do more. I hope that we will do more to address Ms. Ellis's concerns and the concerns that I think are shared by many, many Americans. My colleagues should not be afraid to hear from the American people. I think we all might learn something. So I will not be able to support the Citizens United rule. We'll have a counter motion on that. I will support the McCutcheon, both the interim final rule and the advance notice of proposed rulemaking. I will note that even the process on that is not my my preferred way of going forward. We're issuing an interim final rule, which means we're issuing the rule and then we're asking for comments later. And while I'm going to vote for it because I can't think of any controversial aspects of the implementation of that narrower decision, somebody else might think of them out there. And it's my experience that it's a lot easier to get something right the first time than to try and correct mistakes after the fact. So I'm going to keep my fingers crossed and hope that we're getting it right in the interim final rule and encourage anybody who thinks we missed something to please submit comments on that. And I am very excited about the hearing that we're going to be holding on the advance notice of proposed rulemaking. And again, I really, really encourage everybody out there to comment on that. We didn't get a lot of comments. I mean, one of my colleagues said we got a lot of comments on the NPRM that we're resolving today. We got nine because the issues were so narrowed that there really was not much exciting there to deal with. And I'm hoping that we're going to do a lot better on this and we'll get some real comment because I think there is some real interest by at least some of us in making some changes around here.
Commissioner Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I will be supporting the rule that is in agenda document 1453-A, which will, I think, it's a long overdue updating of our rules and regulations. As the vice chair pointed out, it's been over 4 years since Citizens United was handed down, and there has been, I think, for those few who might be steeped in our rules and regulations, know what the decision and the holding of Citizens United was, but it's frankly been a shame that it's taken this long to just get our rules in compliance with what the decisions of the court have been. And so I think that it will be, I think, a positive step that we can prevent any future and unnecessary confusion and misunderstanding about what our rules actually do and do not say. I'll also be supporting the interim draft rule in relating to the McCutcheon decision as well as the advance notice of proposed rulemaking that is on the agenda here as well. One, I think, important thing needs to I'm not going to talk too much, but I think one important part of the history that relates to this rulemaking and the story that's led up to it was omitted by my colleague, Commissioner Weintraub. And that was following the Citizens United decision, Congress undertook to amend the laws and put into place a much more expansive disclosure regime. Some thought I'm not going to get into the pros or the cons of that particular legislation, but this was debated, and it was debated at a point which was probably a high watermark in terms of the numbers of members of Congress, both in the House and Senate, who supported a more robust and expansive and in many ways intrusive campaign finance regulatory regime. That was the Disclose Act. That act did not pass. Since that time, any efforts to revive that act have gone nowhere. And as a commissioner, I don't feel like I can ignore what's happened on the congressional level. Congress writes the laws, and it's not particularly appropriate for an agency to seek to achieve through regulation which could not be achieved through legislation. The versions of past rulemakings that we debated at length here at the FEC, some of them were basically regulatory versions of the Disclose Act. Now, again, I don't want to necessarily get into the merits. I didn't support those on the substance, but I also had a principled reason that when Congress has spoken and chose not to act and has chosen not to act, that factor cannot be ignored. I think that there are some things that may be able to be done. I think that the pragmatic approach that was enunciated by the vice chair is as a positive one. I think that there are areas where we can make progress and where we can move the ball forward. We have had disagreements about and strong debates about the scope and meaning of Citizens United, as well as what the appropriate regulatory response to that decision should be. And we're going to continue to debate those. That decision, as well as several other decisions which have been handed down as well, that relate to such issues as political committee status and what should be done about what is the proper level of disclosure. But notwithstanding those debates, I think that we have an obligation as the agency that is entrusted with bringing clarity to the legal landscape, that we, at a minimum, we need to bring our own rules into compliance with the court decisions that we have been discussing. And I think by getting this logjam out of the way, I hope that this will now enable us to work more productively and find those areas where we can find common agreement and consensus, because I think there are probably more than what maybe some people might think. So I do thank the vice chair. I thank Commissioner Hunter and the chairman for all of their efforts to try to get this to this point, which was no small undertaking. And the work of OGC to prepare all the documents and to accommodate the back and forth, the barrage of questions and concerns and requests for edits has been expansive, and their work has been tremendous throughout this, and I also want to thank the various staff members who have done so much to be able to get us to a point where we can vote on this today. I want to thank my two EAs, John Borrowman and David Adkins, for all the they've contributed to the process and for their help as we've gotten to this point. I would also put in my pitch that the ANPRM, which is coming out, ask questions that are rooted in the McCutchen decision. I would certainly encourage any and all who wish to be heard on that to submit comments so that we can have a full record before us, so that we can, as we make our decisions and consider what next steps we need to take with respect to the McCutchen decision, that we have as much information before us as we can. But again, I plan to support the rule that we have before us, and both the Citizens United rule as well as the interim rule and the ANPRM that relate to McCutchen. Thanks.
Mr. Walther.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I join the comments of Commissioner Weintraub, and maybe you notice some angst in our voices, and it's because I think we've lived through this whole process for so long and have been frustrated because we haven't been able to accomplish more. And I give the impression is potentially left today that what we're doing now has not been done before, but I do want to emphasize that as soon as Citizens came down, within 15 days, we issued a written policy on how we viewed it and how to be guided by it. And that was made public and immediately disseminated, so that within 15 days of Citizens United, the public who wanted to know understood where the FEC was going to go with respect to guidance. What we do today is formalize it by rules, something that we certainly could have done a long time ago and haven't done, but they've always were coupled with naggy little issues like foreign investment and other disclosure types of issues that prevented us from putting a package together. So this advances the cause in terms of formalizing our regulatory scheme with Citizens United. This is all good, but there's a lot left. I also, with Commissioner Weintraub, would not be able to support it because it does implicate a couple of rules that I think I don't want to be listed as one of those that ratified that in view of the way they're being interpreted today. And I have a separate statement on that. And I know we have a very short period of time today because somebody has to leave at 12. So I'm prepared to make a motion when we are to do that, which will garner two votes for sure, and then we can move on to the rest of it. And I know that everybody is happy, and I hope we can get more collegial. I look forward to the fact that we now will be able to have some public comment. But once again, I think it needs to be a caution that there's no rules out there that we could get a vote on for consideration on some of these more naggy issues. we'll have a hearing, but we're not able to propose any draft rules for consideration or more precise debate.
Commissioner Hunter.
Just two quick comments. One, Commissioner Weintraub mentioned that there were only 9 comments, and while that's true, the commenters represented tens of thousands of people, including unions and the Chamber of Commerce. So they were a lot of comments from groups of people, and those groups represented a lot of different people. And I thought they were thoughtful, well-written comments. And second, as Commissioner Peterson said, Congress could not pass the Disclose Act. And so the failure to legislate is not a mandate for the FEC to regulate. And agencies like the FEC should not use their rulemaking authority to circumvent the legislative process. Thanks.
Commissioner Weintraub.
I agree. And our proposal that we tried to put out for public comment was not an attempt to enact the Disclose Act by regulation. It was an attempt to go back to the law that Congress adopted in 2002, which the Commission mucked up with our regulation and which, frankly, some of my colleagues further mucked up with a, I can't describe it any other way, completely preposterous interpretation in the FreedomWorks MER, which seemed to be designed to completely eviscerate the disclosure provisions. So we're just trying to get back to what's already on the statute book.
Well, let me just say first, we owe a great bit of gratitude and appreciation and congratulations to Vice Chair Ravel and Commissioner Hunter for breaking a near 5-year impasse at this commission. And sometimes I feel like it is like moving a boulder 2 inches. Some people would think that merely conforming your regulations to the Constitution of the United States as interpreted by the Supreme Court is a perfunctory matter. This was no perfunctory matter. And there were profound issues at stake. But in addition to the profound substantive issues, there was a profound obligation of this commission to discharge its first responsibility to comply with the Constitution of the United States and to conform our regulations to the First Amendment's mandate. Today, if we vote for these 3 items, we will do that, and it will be a good day for the Constitution, and it will be a good day for this commission to demonstrate that it has the power and the functionality to do that. Second, in addition to conforming our regulations to the Constitution, embedded in these proposals are important clarifications. And ordinary citizens who live in Des Moines, Iowa, in Oregon, in Nebraska, who pick up our Code of Federal Regulations should be able to rely on its accuracy and its basic constitutionality. So, conforming our regulations to the Constitution is a good start, but there are also very important clarifications for the secondary implications of Citizens United in this proposed rulemaking, and I think that is a very important step as well, and one that I hope we can continue to work on over the next year, Vice Chair Ravel, when you take this gavel. And third, I want to say I support these 3 items because they do represent profound freedoms for the American people to speak in our democracy. There are 4 court decisions actually institutionalized in this rulemaking. The Citizens United decision, the McCutcheon decision, the Kerry decision, and the SpeechNow.org decision. While the aim was to conform our regulations to Citizens United and McCutcheon for the first time ever, there will be a note in our regulations recognizing Kerry and SpeechNow as well. So the effect of these regulations will be to encourage more speakers to join the public debate. More speakers and more viewpoints is a good thing for our democracy. And so on a substantive basis, this is a very important bit of progress for our commission. On the ANPRM, Commissioner Weintraub, I agree with you. I support free speech. I think debate is enhanced the more viewpoints we have, and I support that outside this building, and I also support it inside this building. So when Vice Chair Ravel said, or proposed, that we open our doors to more comment on a broader set of regulatory issues, I think Vice Chair Ravel will tell you, I fully embrace that notion from the first day we began discussing this. And so I do think it will be constructive for the Commission to receive broad and vast public comment on the issues raised in the CANPRM, and I welcome them, and I join you in encouraging citizens to bring us comments to inform the public debate here inside this building as well. As you all know, each year our Code of Federal Regulations gets a new color. I don't know what the color will be in 2015. They vary green to red to purple. But what I do know is if these motions pass, and I hope that they will and I expect them to, the book that is published in 2015 will be about 5 pages lighter. It will be clearer, and it will be constitutional and encourage more speech in the public forum. And so for that reason, I will support all 3 of these items today. Are there any other comments or questions? Commissioner Weintraub.
I'm happy to hear, Mr. Chairman, that you're supportive of the First Amendment inside and outside the building. I will note that over the course of the last year, I have on several occasions asked my colleagues whether we could go back to some of the items that have been on the Commission's to-do list for quite a long time and do rulemakings that would allow all sides to put in all of their questions, just like the Commission used to do back in the day when we used to spit out 6 or 8 rulemakings a year. And I've gotten no takers on that suggestion. So, you know, I would be very happy to work with you on that if indeed that's a sincere offer, Mr. Chairman, because there's plenty of issues out there on which there's a diversity of viewpoints in the building, and it would be nice to know that folks on the other side of the table are willing to put all the viewpoints out for public comment.
Vice Chair Ravel.
Sorry to prolong this, but first let me say I think this is an important step forward in that process, and we are committed to moving on several rulemakings, including some of the things that were discussed today. The issues, and I just have to address this from sort of a legalistic standpoint to make some clarity in this, and I did say it before, but we are doing today a narrow rulemaking to conform the regulations based on the NPRM that is already in existence, and we cannot go, as everyone knows, outside the scope of that NPRM. And specifically, there was nothing in it about foreign corporations or disclosure, and also specifically nothing about Kerry or Speech Now. So while all those issues, I absolutely agree, are significant and really important and need to be addressed by this commission, hopefully today is the beginning of our ability to sit down and have reasonable discussions regarding all those subjects.
Would any other commissioner like to speak to the items? Commissioner Walther, any further comment?
Could we have just a moment to talk procedurally on an issue?
Yes, we'll recess for
make it quick
for 3 minutes. A motion. As I indicated earlier, we would take up each item. We discussed each item together, and we will take up each item separately in a separate motion.
I move approval of agenda document number 14-53A, Citizens United versus FEC rulemaking, and I authorize OGC to make any technical and conforming edits.
Okay. Is there any discussion or further? Are there any further motions, Commissioner Walther?
I would offer an amendment to the motion, and the motion would be to approve the final rule set forth in Agenda Document 14-53A, except to strike the phrase now in quotations and were not made by a corporation or labor organization pursuant to 11 CFR 114.15 end of quotes in paragraph. Parens C, parens 8, from Section 104.2 of the Commission's regulations. I can't believe I missed that. 104.20 of the Commission's regulations entitled, quote, reporting electioneering communications, and also to strike paragraph C9 in its entirety from Section 104.20.20 of the Commission's regulations entitled, quote, reporting electioneering communications, unquote.
So I can reread it for the Secretary. Madam Secretary, I'll reread that.
Thank you.
So the pending motion by Commissioner Walther is to amend the main motion to strike the phrase, quote, and were not made by a corporation or labor organization pursuant to 11 CFR 114.15, close quote, in paragraph C8 from section 104.20 of the Commission's regulations entitled, quote, reporting electioneering communications, close quote, and to strike paragraph C9 in its entirety from section 104.20 of the Commission's regulations entitled, quote, reporting electioneering communications, close quote. And we can supply you a copy of this, but do you have that?
Yes, thank you.
Okay, so there.
Mr. Chair, could I have a point of clarification and perhaps from general counsel on this matter? Generally, my understanding is that if there's an amendment to the motion, that the maker of the motion has to agree to the amendment to the motion.
No, and that's not my understanding.
Okay,
of Robert's
and
rules.
I just want to make sure that it doesn't in any way bind me to that motion, that amendment.
The way that normally under Robert's rules I would proceed is to recognize this is a secondary motion, a motion to amend your main motion. We will have a separate vote on the Commissioner Walther's motion to amend.
Okay.
If it passes, it will amend your main motion. If it fails, then we go right back to the main motion.
Exactly.
Any other questions or comments? You want to speak to the motion? Or?
No, we already spoke.
Okay.
We're running out of time.
Okay, then, we'll go to a vote. We are voting on Commissioner Walther's motion to amend the main motion. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed?
No.
No. No. The motion fails by a vote of 2-4 with Commissioners Weintraub and Walther voting in the affirmative, Commissioners Hunter, Peterson, Ravel, and Goodman voting no. So now we're going back to the main motion, which is Vice Chair Ravel's motion. Any further comment? Hearing none, we'll vote on the main motion to adopt agenda item number 14-53A, the final rules on independent expenditures and electioneering communications by corporations and labor organizations. All in favor of that motion, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. All opposed?
No.
No.
The motion passes by a vote of 4-2, with Commissioners Hunter, Peterson, Ravel, and Goodman voting in favor, and Commissioners Weintraub and Walther voting no. Vice Chair Ravel?
I move approval of agenda document number 14-51-A, McCutcheon versus FEC interim final rule, and authorize the Office of General Counsel to make any technical and conforming edits.
Any further comments? Any further motions? All in favor, say aye.
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 Aye. Aye. Any opposed? The motion passes by a vote of 6-0. Next motion.
I move approval of agenda document number 14-52-A, McCutcheon versus FEC, advance notice of proposed rulemaking.
Any further comments or debate or further motions? Hearing none, we'll go to a vote. All in favor, say aye.
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 Aye. Aye. Any opposed? Any abstentions? The motion passes by a vote of 6-0. Well, I want to congratulate the commission. I want to congratulate the staff and thank you all. Esther, Theo, Amy, Adav, your whole team, Joanna, thank you all for, thank you, Cheryl. Thank you all for, there was a lot of work that went to this, and I think this is a good day for the commission. And again, before we move on, I want to thank Vice Chair Ravel and Commissioner Hunter for a good bit of work to move this commission forward. Thank you all. Okay, we will move on to agenda item number 5 now. Draft Advisory Opinion 2014-12.
Sorry. This motion?
2014-12.
No, this is mine.
With submitters from the Democratic National Committee and the Republican National Committee.
Oh.
I'd like to invite Mr. Bauer and Mr. Phillippe and Ms. Stowe to come to the table in case there are any questions of the requesters. Jessica, are you doing this? Okay. And we have Mr. Noti and Jessica Selenkoff from our Office of General Counsel, who've done a good bit of work on this one, too. It's been busy in Mr. Noti's shop. And I want to welcome Mr. Bauer on behalf of the Democratic National Committee, Mr. Phillippe. Ashley, you going to stay and watch?
we have extras here, I suppose. We can.
And I'm sorry.
It's Graham Wilson.
Mr. Wilson.
Also on, right? But
you can
however you'd
up
like
a
to proceed.
Chair.
We don't need, Mr. Phillippe and I don't need full fortification, but a little assistance is always appreciated.
Ms. Stowe, always nice to see you back in the building. Okay, Ms. Selenkoff, do you have a presentation for the commission?
Thank you, Chair Goodman. Good morning, commissioners. Agenda documents 14-50-A and 14-50-B present two draft advisory opinions in response to a request by the Democratic National Committee and the Republican National Committee. The DNC and RNC are national party committees that until recently were entitled to receive public funds to defray expenses incurred with respect to their presidential nominating conventions. Effective in April of this year, however, the Gabriella Miller Kids First Research Act terminated their entitlement to public funds. The DNC and RNC propose to raise funds under separate contribution limits into either a segregated account or a separate convention committee to finance expenses for their respective conventions. Draft A concludes that the DNC and RNC may not raise funds subject to an additional contribution limit, whether into a segregated account or into a separate convention committee, to pay these convention expenses. Draft B concludes that the DNC and RNC may establish convention committees to raise and spend federal funds for convention expenses under a separate contribution limit because the convention committees would be separate national party committees. The Commission received 4 comments on the drafts, including from the requesters. If the Commission approves a draft today, the Office of General Counsel asks for authority to make technical and conforming changes to the final document, and I'm available for any questions you may have.
Okay. Does any commissioner have any questions for Ms. Selenkoff or the requesters' representatives? Anna, are we ready to go to motions?
And maybe could we make a statement?
As well? I'm sorry.
No
questions
question.
Or comments? Yes.
Oh,
I'm sorry.
No question. Okay. This request, it gave rise to a number of comments, and it was subject to a great deal of thought on my part. First and foremost, I think that the parties and their conventions are unique and very important parts of our participatory democracy. National conventions and the delegate selections, platform debates, and other things that are done at those conventions are a means, in my view, to encourage political participation, and that's important. That's what we need in our society, is to have more civic engagement and more participation in politics. And that's one of the sort of underlying factors for this commission and what we really stand for. Since these proposed committees will raise money only for conventions, it makes sense to me to think of them as a separate part of the party's national organizations. In thinking about the AO request, though, I seriously and carefully considered the views of the commenters other than the requesters that were received by the commission. And I appreciate assistance that is given from those outside to help us in our deliberation. But in making my decision, I think it is important that the convention committees proposed by the requesters would continue to be subject to all the requirements of FECA, including disclosure requirements and contribution limits. And further, as stated in Draft B, they're going to spend money exclusively on convention expenses, nothing else, and they will not advocate for candidates or support any other general party activities. So this AO in Draft B presents it's a unique and very constrained set of circumstances. It won't permit these committees to spin off into separate committees. Rather, because of the long history of political committees being a unique function of political parties, and because the public funding statute specifically treated them like the House and Senate committees as separate national committees, no other committees could really meet these requirements. So there should not be any proliferation of national committees, as was suggested by some of the commenters as a result of Draft B. This is a narrow, limited, and cabined approach. And so given these constraints and limiting factors, I think for our political system, it's right to approve this request, and I will vote for Draft B.
Commissioner Weintraub.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate the constraints that the party committees are operating under, and that you guys feel kind of under the gun with in competition with all these unlimited committees that are now out there. And as I'm sure you'll recall, I've been with you on some of these requests that you've made that to try and give you a little bit more breathing space, where I felt that there was a credible legal argument that we could use to get there. I'm having a hard time with this one. And we asked our staff to come up with the best argument for a yes, and they did. But ultimately, I'm just not sure that I find it persuasive. In a blog post this morning, Mr. Bauer, you said that running the conventions is a core function of the parties. So if it's a core function of the DNC and the RNC to run these national conventions, how can it be the responsibility of a separate national party committee? If it's your core function, then don't you have to do it?
Thank you, Commissioner Weintraub. I actually was addressing a very specific contention in one of the comments, and that comment was that convention activity focuses exclusively on presidential and vice presidential candidacies. And my point is that that's not accurate. So from a national committee analysis, it is not correct to say that this is an organization that's solely interested in promoting the presidential and vice presidential nominees of the party. Then if you look at how the commission has looked at those issues over the years and the other factors they've taken into consideration in determining what is a national committee, it seems to me the multiplicity of functions within the convention context support a national committee determination, and the law is clear. The determination of what is a national committee is a commission determination based on those factors. So that was the specific circumstance, the specific issue I was addressing in the blog posting that you referred to.
I appreciate the attempts to make sure that this is not going to be the beginning of a proliferating series of committees. I mean, what we're talking about are the contribution limits, and obviously the members of Congress who voted for this research bill could have. I mean, it's not like they were unfamiliar with the conventions or with the notion that they would have to fund them some other way if they weren't going to get the public funds. They could have said, and we're going to give ourselves another contribution limit to pay for this, and they didn't. So I'm having a hard time with the argument that, well, you know, this is sort of an unforeseeable circumstance that you would find yourself in this bind. We can't rely on the argument that it's not an election, as we did in the recount AO, because under our regulations, the convention is indeed an election. I'm not finding the legal analysis into why, after all these years, we suddenly discovered that national convention committees are a separate national party committee. They've been around for a long time. Who knew? Nobody ever suggested that before. And that doesn't mean that it can't be right, because nobody ever thought of it before, because it's always good to have new ideas. But I just am not finding the legal rationale that's advanced in the draft compelling enough to do in this circumstance. I do think that we need to here's another rulemaking project. We need to revise our convention regulations, obviously, in light of the Research Act. And I would be open to exploring this issue in a rulemaking context. I'm not there today. And I do think, by the way, that we are capable of doing a rulemaking on an expedited basis on an issue like this that perhaps does not present huge, controversial, you know, back and forth, rock'em sock'em issues. And as I said, you know, we used to do expedited rulemakings. Commissioners worked hard and staff worked hard, and we would turn out 6 or 8 of them a year. And I think that we could do it on an expedited basis, and that would be a better way of addressing this particular issue. But I'm not there on the AO today. To me, it seems that the no answer in draft A is the more compelling legal analysis. As much as I would like to support the party committees, I just don't think the legal analysis works for me. I will say I think we have time for me to go on a slight tangent. We do find ourselves more and more often doing in the AO context something that I think a lot of commissioners feel like maybe would be more appropriate to do in a rulemaking. And I think in light of that change in the way we do business around here, that we should consider a change in the way we hold these hearings. We adopted a rule, a procedure a number of years ago to allow the requesters to come and sit in front of us and answer questions, and sometimes it turns more into an oral argument. You're not arguing too much because you can see that you're winning, so you are wisely just listening. But often it does turn into more of an oral argument, and the concern has been raised by some other folks out there who comment on these things, that they feel disadvantaged because they don't get to come to the table and engage with the commissioners on some of these issues. So I had originally envisioned these kinds of back and forths as more an opportunity to get factual information, and for that it seemed like the requester would be the only person in a position to provide the facts. But I think given the way these have evolved, I am going to have my staff work on a proposal to amend our procedures so that we can have other people can request to sit at the table, or we might need more chairs, and weigh in on some of these advisory opinions. And I hope that there might be support for that change to our procedures. But and I think this would have been a good one to have been able to have that kind of back and forth from other folks who are concerned on this issue. But regrettably, I've been there for the party committees on a number of occasions in the past, and I hope to be in the future, but I'm just not there today.
Any other commissioner? Commissioner Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I plan to support draft B as well for many of the same reasons that the vice chair articulated. This is a measured response to a specific request seeking guidance and clarity regarding how national political party conventions are going to be financed now that the entitlement to public funds has been terminated. As has been pointed out, the request delineates that the proposed use of the funds raised by the convention committees would be limited to expenses primarily for logistical considerations that relate to physical convention sites, security, administrative expenses, transportation, meetings related to party rules, platform development, etc. And the funds at issue, it's not soft money, is not creeping into the system. That these would be funds that would be subject to the limits of the Act, as well as the source prohibitions and the reporting requirements. I think that in light of the fact that the commission is specifically authorized to determine what is a national committee, I think that the facts that are presented by this request, I think, you know, applying the test that that is the tests that have been articulated before by the commission about how we determine what is and what is not a national committee, I think that the convention committee does meet that test. I would just to address, I think, a question that was raised by Commissioner Weintraub asking why, you know, convention committees have been around a long time. Why haven't they ever been considered a national committee? I think I guess we're speculating, but I would render the guess that the reason why is because up until this point, they've been the recipients of public funds. This issue has never been teed up before and is never, and therefore the question has never needed to be answered about whether or not convention committees might also be national committees that are themselves entitled to a separate contribution limit, but that entitlement has now been terminated. And so for the first time, really, this question of whether or not a convention committee is also a national committee under the statute is ripe for our consideration. And when applying the factors that are part of our traditional analysis for under both the statute and the and under the regulations for determining national committee status, I support the draft that does find that they do qualify under both the statutory and regulatory tests, and for that reason, I am going to support draft B as well.
Any other commissioner? Commissioner Walter.
Well, the votes are in, so I mean, I understand that. I just want to add my concern about it's almost deja vu, only with a different issue, and that is whether or not, in the absence of statutory authorization, we or in view of immediate, decision to repeal a statute, either by judicial fiat or otherwise, where does that leave us? Earlier today, because we've argued that in the absence of Citizens United, a hole was left that we should at least hear from the public on to determine what further steps we should take. Here we're being confronted with a situation where the legislature has actually removed a source of funding for the conventions and has said nothing about either supplementing it or encouraging the commission to find a way to supplement it. The core of what we do is to follow and try and comply with the statutory provisions with respect to how money is spent, how much it can be spent, how it can be spent, but not really to create ways for it to be spent that aren't envisioned statutorily. And I'm concerned about that. I have been in the past, and again in the past I've supported the parties on this, and I know the commission has too, found ways to make it work better, but it's hard for me conceptually, and I really think the arguments in draft A are persuasive. I guess what concerns me too sometimes is talking about procedure, how we work on some of these more important matters. Sometimes we're confronted with some very good arguments, an oral argument, and I'd like to be able to walk away and think about it and maybe look and do some more research and then be in a position to make a decision. The way we're structured now, we aren't typically in that situation. We hear presentations, but typically we make a decision immediately after that without the ability to, look a little further into some of these ways of seeing things. So I think that's a weakness on occasion in the way we make our own decisions.
Commissioner Hunter.
We don't need a specific legislative permission to consider whether a committee is a national committee. And we have the ability to do that under the regs. I don't think we need to do a regulation unless we think, I think what Commissioner Weintraub said, and I may have heard you wrong, is that you'd be willing to consider something like this in a rulemaking. But if you think it's not permissible under the statute, then a rulemaking wouldn't address that. So I'm not really sure where people are coming from, but I think we have it, within our authority to determine whether a committee is a national committee. And for the reasons that the Vice Chair and Commissioner Peterson explained, I, too, will support draft B.
let me just ask Mr. Philippi and Mr. Bauer, do you have any reactions to the colloquy you've heard here?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think I will be very brief in response to that question, in deference to Commissioner Weintraub's point that if we're winning, maybe it's not a good idea to talk too much. But I do want to express...
Mr. Bauer, it's your turn.
our appreciation for everyone's recognition of our plight. I do think, is a very... modest step in favor of the parties, and as we all know, are the most transparent and accountable and limited entities in our system. I would like to make one point, which may be a little bit nuanced, but maybe we'll give Commissioner Weintraub a little bit of reassurance, is that there is a distinction between the party and the party committees. And to say something that putting on the convention is a core function of the party, the convention is different than the committee. The party is much broader than what federal law defines as political committees. And in fact, but for the convention, the Republican National Committee would not exist. The convention is a bringing together of delegates who represent the entire spectrum of the party and come together and pass rules and a platform and actually create the Republican National Committee every 4 years. So I would urge you to recognize that they're not synonymous, and that by the party in that context, it's very logical for there to be more than one national committee. And certainly we already have a congressional and a senatorial committee, and I think the logic there does support the idea that a national committee can exist for conventions as well. Regardless of which way you're going to vote on this, I do appreciate that the commission acknowledges the problem we're in. We're going to keep working on behalf of the parties with Congress and the commission and to keep working to solve these sorts of problems. So thank you very much.
In fact, I have a question then. A convention is technically a separate legal entity with its own governance structure, right? I mean, it determines its own rules. It has a sponsoring organization, which would be the Republican National Committee or the Democratic National, but then it takes on a life of its own, and the party doesn't dictate what happens in that hall in terms of adopting the rules and all of those aspects, right?
There is
a rules committee, and there is an adoption of the rules. There is a credentials committee determining who gets in the room to vote on those matters. I mean, it technically is a separate legal entity, isn't it?
Correct. It is a separate entity. Correct.
Okay. Mr. Bauer?
Two very quick things. First of all, Commissioner Weintraub, you said I wasn't arguing because I thought I was winning. You asked me a specific question. I answered it. I'm happy to argue with you now.
I know you are.
You tell me that you're open-minded and the argument will lead you to the successful conclusion. We can be here all day.
We'll go out to lunch. We'll have a drink.
Whatever is required, yes. But I wanted to be clear. I'm more than happy to take on any particular points if you're interested in them. If not, we don't have to pursue it. But I do want to say one thing about the question of what Congress did or did not intend in voting to terminate public funding. If we're going to look for settled legal analysis, I really honestly don't think we can read into Congress's action on one issue a choice it made not to act on another issue. I've never heard that suggested, and I just don't think that's accurate. Congress could easily have made the decision, indeed did make the determination, to reallocate the funding from the convention to another medical research purpose. In so doing, there's no indication that it intended to express an opinion by implication that some other legal avenue for assisting the parties under the Federal Election Campaign Act was not available. I don't think that's a recognized construction of congressional intent. And the second point I would make then also is, therefore, it leaves things, and I think Commissioner Hunter was making this point, where they are, which is that this commission has the capacity under the statute to construe what is a national committee. And there are multiple national committees. And in fact, just going back to the origins of the statute, there's a shared contribution limit, for example, between the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee and the Republican Senatorial Campaign Committee and their national committees, but they are considered, albeit within the party structure, committees that have otherwise separate legal existence and are dedicated to different functions within the party structure. So I just don't see that the commission doesn't have the ongoing regulatory authority by advisory opinion to construe, as it has in other cases, whether it's the Libertarian Party or the USA Taxpayer Party or whatever, to conclude that this convention activity is an activity that is broad enough in purpose that the committee conducting it is, in fact, a national committee. I don't think Congress's act in the Miller statute precludes the commission in any way from acting on existing authority in that respect.
I'm not saying that we're precluded by the Miller Act, and I hope you all appreciate the good work of our staff in coming up with this theory for you, that it's by creating a national party committee, by creating a separate national committee structure for the convention committees, that that would be the way that the commission could, under the statute and through an AO, grant you this, because that was not one that you suggested. I think our staff came up with that, and I'm not philosophically opposed to what is going to happen here today. I'm not hot under the collar about this. I would. I also share the concern that's been voiced about supporting the party committees. I just don't think the legal analysis works. I find the legal analysis in Draft A more compelling than the legal analysis in Draft B. So you're probably right, Mr. Bauer. Much as I would be delighted, and I'm sure it would be very entertaining to argue with you all day, at the end of the day, we probably wouldn't be anywhere different than where we are right now.
Well, let me just conclude. I think it's important. And I'm sorry, Commissioner Walther.
One thing I didn't get a chance to say, and I meant to, is I do. I guess that it can be said that I share your pain in the sense that I do think that Citizens United and the new sources of money have made it. I wouldn't say weakened the party system, but certainly made it more difficult for the party system to continue in a leadership capacity in the way it has. And I'm worried about that. And I would welcome a legislative look at what can be done to prevent that. I mean, you see the big sources of money that are coming into on independent expenditures, 80% of it are negative. That alone, in addition to the amount and the way it's spent, but who is spending that money and saying negative things without really accountability in the same way that a party does concerns me. And so I'm supportive of ways to strengthen the party.
Well, I think it's important when both of our national parties come to us and say, we need recognition of some regulatory flexibility and right. I think you're hearing raging agreement here on the commission, no, in support of the parties in general. And this obviously is a nuanced issue, and there's a draft A and draft B, and reasonable minds can disagree. I happen to see a reasonable path forward for this to recognize this regulatory flexibility and right for the parties. And so for that reason, I will support draft B. Madam Vice Chair, do we have a... I'm sorry?
If we're going to go to motions, could I make a motion, please?
Yes, ma'am. I'm sorry. I did know you were going to... Commissioner Weintraub.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, I move that the Commission approve Agenda Document 14-50A, a response to Advisory Opinion Request 2014-12.
Any further comments regarding the pending motion? Madam Secretary, you have the motion. Then we'll go to vote. All in favor signify by saying aye.
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 All opposed say no.
No.
No. The motion fails by a vote of 2-4. Commissioners Weintraub and Walther voting aye. Commissioners Hunter, Peterson, Ravel, and Goodman voting no. Madam Vice Chair.
With respect to Advisory Opinion Request 2014-12, Democratic National Committee and Republican National Committee, I move approval of Agenda Document Number 14-50-B, which is Draft B, and authorize OGC to make any necessary technical and conforming edits.
Any further comments regarding the pending motion? Hearing none, we'll go to vote. All in favor, say aye.
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 Aye. Aye. All opposed?
No.
Motion passes by a vote of 4-2. Commissioners Hunter, Peterson, Ravel, and Goodman voting yay. Commissioners Walther and Weintraub voting no. Gentlemen, Ashley, thank you for coming. Thank you. Okay, the we're going to take up the next two items again for discussion together. Items 6 and 7 on the agenda, Draft Advisory Opinion 2014-14, Trammell, and Draft Advisory Opinion 2014-15, Bratt. Without objection, we'll take these two items up for discussion together because they raise the same issues. And then if we get to a vote today, we would take them up separately. And I believe Joanna Waldstreicher and Bob Knopp, Joanna, you're going to make this presentation. Bob, thank you for being here and for all your hard work as well over the past few weeks. So, Ms. Waldstreicher, you're going to make a presentation of these. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good morning, Commissioners. Agenda documents 1448A, A2, and B, and 1449A, A2, and B are alternative draft responses to substantially identical advisory opinion requests submitted by John Trammell and David Bratt, respectively. Mr. Trammell and Mr. Bratt are both candidates for the U.S. House of Representatives in Virginia's 7th District, and both candidates are employed by Randolph-Macon College, a Virginia corporation. The college has offered, and both candidates have accepted, unpaid leaves of absence for the duration of their campaigns, and they have entered memoranda of understanding with the college, setting forth the terms of the leaves of absence. One of those terms provides for the continuation of fringe benefits for which the candidates were eligible prior to the leaves of absence, including medical, life, and disability insurance, and tuition remission. The candidates both ask whether the terms of the MOUs are consistent with the Act and Commission regulations. Draft A of both advisory opinions concludes that the continuation of fringe benefits during the candidate's leaves of absence is prohibited under sections 114.12(c)(1) and 113.1(g)(6) of the Commission regulations. Revised Draft A reaches the same conclusion except as to tuition remission, which it concludes may be continued during the candidate's leaves of absence. Draft B of both advisory opinions concludes that the continuation of fringe benefits during the leaves of absence is permissible under Section 113.1(g)(6) and Advisory Opinion 1992-03, Reynolds. We did not receive any comments on the request, and we received two comments on the drafts. If the Commission approves responses to the advisory opinion request, the Office of General Counsel requests authority to make any necessary technical and conforming changes, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Okay, the floor is open for commissioners for any questions or comments. I believe we've got some discussion ahead of us. Yes. Commissioner Weintraub.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I've been on the fence on this one. I found this to be a very difficult and compelling request. In a world where when parties are out recruiting candidates, the first question they ask is, how much money do you have? And the second question they ask is, how much money do your friends and family have for setting up super PACs? It's refreshing to see a race that has two working folk, shall we say, running against each other. Not a big dollar race of one millionaire against another. And I think it's good for the country to have more people who come from different walks of life feel like they can afford to try to run for Congress and that it's not something that's out of their reach. So telling them that they have to dig into their pocket to pay for their family's health insurance and, you know, make up the employer share in addition to going on leave without pay and sacrificing their salary, you know, it's asking a lot of people. We're asking them to make a sacrifice for the sake of the country. And, I mean, you know, there are other benefits to running for Congress and potentially being in Congress. But I think it's a good thing for the Commission to think about ways that we could help to encourage more people from different walks of life to aspire to run for Congress and not view it as something that's out of their reach. You know, the problem here is we have a regulation that looks pretty clear on its face that corporations aren't allowed to pay for their share of the benefits. But if you look at the legislative history and the subsequent AOs, that regulation, which looks clear on its face, maybe is not so clear, and the Commission has already weighed in on that and established that there are it's not really as clear as it seems. And it really goes to how discretionary the benefit is. I mean, I think the commission, when it many years ago adopted this regulation, was probably concerned that corporations not gin up ways to supplement the income and provide more money to candidates just to you know, find a backdoor way of supporting their campaigns. That's plainly not what's happening here. It's kind of baked into the academic life that a lot of academics take leaves of absence for one reason or another to advance their professional goals. And that seems to be a longstanding practice here at this college, that they allow their faculty to do that sort of thing. And others in similar circumstances have taken advantage of that. And it seems to be pretty much pro forma that once that permission is granted, that the benefits will be continued. And again, it's a longstanding college practice and doesn't seem to be something that would be denied except in fairly extraordinary circumstances. Plus, we have the unique fact here that both candidates work for the same employer, and the employer is seeking to provide this benefit to both candidates in the race. So it is clear they are not trying to influence the outcome of the election because they are giving the same benefit to both candidates. So in some ways, this is a fairly unique situation and perhaps will never come up again where two employees of the same employer are running against each other for Congress. So I think there are a lot of reasons why I am inclined to support the request. I also note that while it's not directly analogous, the Commission has on a couple of occasions granted companies the ability to pay severance payments to employees as they left their job and went to run for Congress. And I personally voted against those opinions because I thought that there was far more discretion involved in those, and it was far harder to say that this was a standard thing that those companies were doing and would do for any employee, because in fact they didn't do it for every employee. There are all sorts of ifs, ands, and buts. This seems to me to be a lot less discretionary. It's a small amount of money. It's a very limited period of time. It's consistent with the longstanding practice of the college. Clearly not intended to influence the election and not designed, they didn't gin up this policy just for this purpose, to help out either one of these guys or both of them. So for all of those reasons, I am inclined to say yes to this. We obviously had a lot on the table today, and I think we're still working on editing the drafts, but I am hopeful that by the end of the day we'll have some language worked out that I would be prepared to support and that I hope that at least three of my colleagues would be prepared to support, and we could vote on tally and settle it that way so as not to needlessly prolong the meeting.
Commissioner Walther.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I agree with Commissioner Weintraub. I'm supportive of trying to work through the analysis so that we can make this happen. I think it's highly unlikely that the entities, the college would exercise discretion. And this, you have to recognize that I think discretion is almost always available to do something one way or the other in a case like this. So just because it's there doesn't mean we have to see it as an obstacle. I really think in a case like this, under these facts, it would be so rare that it would be exercised that we really shouldn't concern ourselves with it.
Mm-hmm. Commissioner Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think Commissioner Weintraub is on the right track on this, that the question here really is whether the proposed payment of fringe benefits is being offered in a manner similar to others who go on sabbatical or go on leave and who aren't candidates. And I think that from the information we have before us, it seems like it's clear that they aren't being offered more favorable terms than anybody else who would seek leave or be going on sabbatical. So I certainly look forward to working with you to find a way in which we can find agreement on this advisory opinion. Commissioner Weintraub mentioned that they work for the same employer, and I would just note that it's not just any employer. It's Randolph-Macon College, the alma mater of Kevin Plummer, my former EA, who is in the audience with us. So it's a significant fact that goes into the analysis.
But we can't show favoritism just because of that, Commissioner.
I just noted for the Gee Whiz collection.
What was your ERA at Randolph-Macon?
Exactly.
Vice Chair Rao.
Well, I may be the only disagreeer, person disagreeing in this case, because I think, as we've discussed in other matters today, we need to look at these issues based on what the law is, what the rules are, and what the principle is that will be a precedent for other matters. And this rule with respect to corporate contributions, paying benefits and the like for people has a very salutary purpose. And I think I don't have any sense that Randolph-Macon College, because these two people are running, is in some way trying to influence them by providing this benefit. But I think this is a very important principle. And actually, the facts of this case are that providing this benefit is totally discretionary with the dean, that often people have not received those benefits or the ability to go on these sabbaticals. It is not uniform. It is not everybody. The college specifically would not indicate who has received it and who hasn't, so we don't have any facts before us. And I will say that, you know, this is not really two working folk, as you say, running against each other. Although admittedly they are working folk, but, you know, I would guess that if a cleaning lady who works for the college wanted to run for Congress, that she might not be getting this leave of absence with benefits. And I think that's the, you know, that's the issue that we have facing us is, you know, what influence does that corporation in a different case want to exercise in a particular race? And I think that's what we're, you know, sort of dealing with here that might be a concern. But I'm more worked up about making sure that I make my flight. Mm-hmm. So it is not the most significant matter, but I do worry about us being too sanguine because of the particular facts here.
We're going to take a little more time. I think we can get to yes on this. I just want to echo some of the other points that have been made. The university sabbatical policies are unique to the context of universities. Corporations aren't typically just letting people take off 6 months or a whole academic year at times. This is so common to academia for people to go to another institution to take a grant and stop teaching and be paid by the grant. And so the what I would call flexibility in their policy should not be confused for whole discretion. It's because of the high number and volume of people who leave regularly that they need to be able to tailor leave packages, because if an individual is going to go to another university that agrees to take up their benefits, well, then you'd want the flexibility in your policy for the provost to tailor the benefit package to that leave. Or you're going to take a grant that pays for certain aspects of a study project but is not going to pay the benefits, well, then you'd want the flexibility to continue the benefits package for that individual. And given the wide variety of sabbaticals and leaves that happen on a university campus, they have to incorporate some flexibility, and I wouldn't overinterpret that to be a whole cloth discretion. And that's why I think this falls on this side of the discretion line, not the other side of our past precedents. And so I think we can get to yes, and I'm happy to incorporate those types of concepts here if we want to address the discretion issue to mitigate any concerns about that. So I take it then that what we're going to do is have Office of General Counsel try to work on a revised draft.
I think we're pretty close to having a proposal to.
Okay. And then we'll try to take that up on tally vote.
Yep.
Conceivably by tomorrow.
Or even today.
Okay. So we're not going to vote on this these two items today. We're going to spend a little bit more time working. Hopefully we'll get it resolved by the end of today or tomorrow. And that brings us to item number 8, management and administrative matters on the agenda. Mr. Palmer, are there any management or administrative matters which the commission must address at this meeting today?
Mr. Chairman, there are no such matters.
Thank you, Mr. Palmer. And that concludes the Federal Election Commission's open meeting for October 9, 2014. Thanks to everyone.